We stand against police brutality in any form. We stand against racism. We stand against hatred or the judging of anyone based on skin color. We believe in equality. We believe in love. We believe Black Lives Matter. We believe you matter. We dedicate this show to the loving memory of Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and sadly, so many other precious lives. He's Ahmed Carr, and I'm Telly Concepcion, and together we are Beyond the Numbers Podcast. We go beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. So come learn, grow, and have some fun with us. We are Beyond the Numbers Podcast.
On today's episode, Ahmed and Telly discuss police brutality, how it has affected them personally, and how athletes are speaking out today. They debate the proposals for a baseball return and share their thoughts on ESPN's 30 for 30, Lance. But first, their numbers of the day.
My number of the day is 10, as in 10 years ago today, being June 7th. Catcher Bryce Harper was drafted by the Washington Nationals as their first pick. He was 17 years old at the time, and he'd been playing in junior college for two seasons, where he pretty much dominated everyone. And the Nationals announced that they were going to move him to the outfield. So any idea who the second pick was in that draft? Jameson Taillon. And then the third pick in that draft was Manny Machado.
My number for the day is 20.1, to be exact. Steven Jackson averaged 20.1 points in the 2007 season for the We Believe Warriors, which reached the playoffs. He filled the team with his heart and passion, and he's using his voice now in the same manner. So for our first story, we wanted to talk about George Floyd and athletes, sports figures, and companies speaking out.
For those of you who don't know, I know we do have a good number of international listeners who may not be fully familiar with the story, but the basic facts are that a police officer held down an African-American individual. It was actually a group of three officers that held him down, and one officer who specifically was on his back and neck with his knee for 8 minutes and 45 seconds, finally killing him in that position. And so many athletes over the past 72 hours, really the past week, have been speaking out about the incident and using their platforms to demonstrate that Black Lives Matter and that police brutality should be something that's no longer tolerated and definitely addressed properly.
We felt that context was important, and we feel that this topic is difficult, but also important to discuss. Before we talk about any specifics about this case and what athletes are saying, I wanted to provide some personal information involving my interactions with the police and the experiences that I've had. And so, you know, for those that don't know, I played football at the University of Florida. I was there from 2004 to 2008. We won the national championship in 2006. You know, I'm a Dominican American. Both my parents are Dominican, so I'm a dark-skinned individual. And so if I were to be pulled over by the police, you know, I appear African American. I appear as a person of color. A lot of people ask me why I wear my championship ring, and Ahmed knows I wear it pretty much every day. And I usually say something along the lines of, you know, I earned it, so I feel the right to wear it. I worked hard for it. I sacrificed my back for it, so I wear it every day. But the truth is that part of the reason that I wear my ring is because of the treatment that I receive from police officers when I'm not wearing the ring versus when I am. So between my freshman and sophomore year of college, I was driving down I-75 in Florida from Gainesville to Tampa. I was pulled over by the police. And apparently for speeding, which I was not. I was in an Xterra and it was packed full of my refrigerator, TV, and all my belongings. Police pulled me over, comes up to the door. He says, "What are you doing, boy?" I'll never forget the fear that I felt in that moment. He looked into the back of the car. He saw that I had a refrigerator, my TV, and all my belongings. I told him, "I'm driving home, sir." He went back to, came back, and he said, "Do you want me to tell your mama that her boy won't be making it home tonight?" I said, "No, sir." And again, the fear that was going through me, because we were on the side of I-75. I can't describe the feeling that I had, that I could have been shot, the story could have changed, and it would be my word against a police officer's word. He eventually wrote me a ticket, the name on the registration, and I told him that was my mom. After harassing me for a couple more minutes, he wrote a ticket saying I was going 20 miles over the speed limit, which again, I wasn't, and he finally let me go. After winning the national championship, I was pulled over in Gainesville, and the cop was being a jerk. He pulled me over. He started yelling from his car. When he came up to get my license and registration, he saw that I had a championship ring on, and his tone completely changed in how he was dealing with me. "Oh, you're on the team? Oh, you guys are great. I love the Florida Gators, and I love you guys. Keep up the great work." And he didn't even write me a ticket. And there's countless stories from my teammates from my time at the University of Florida having the same or similar experience from police officers and fans. So giving that background, I felt it was important to show that I think a lot of athletes feel that they are treated differently because they are professional ball players, because they're college ball players, and that their race in some cases doesn't matter, or they're treated differently because of what they do or their profession. And lending their voice in this instance and lending their voice to social issues is important because more people look up to them, more people think what they have to say is relevant than just someone who works at Google or works at a company day in and day out. So that's my background about it.
So thanks for sharing that. I know that's a difficult piece. I think, you know, you go nationwide, I think everyone's got a story. If you're a person of color, you've had some sort of interaction at some point. You know, I've had multiple over the years. I think the one that stands out to me the most was when I was probably my first year in grad school. I was home, and it was this Friday midday. I'd already finished up with everything for the week. I wasn't working. I was working as a graduate assistant at Rollins, and I was just kind of hanging out doing laundry upstairs, and all of a sudden I hear a banging on the front door downstairs. It's like 2-3 in the afternoon. I don't know what the hell's going on. So I wander downstairs, open the door, look outside, no one outside. So I'm like, all right, this is dumb, but I guess maybe it's summertime, kids are playing around, no big deal. Close the door, go back upstairs, continue doing laundry. All of a sudden I hear the door just being pounded on again. So I was like, oh man, something's up. So I'm getting mad now. Like, really? Like, you did it once, you don't have to keep coming back. So a little mad, I go downstairs, I open the door, no one there. But now I'm like, all right, my neighborhood, you can't go too far. So then I walk around the corner, and as I'm walking towards the garage, all of a sudden I see four police cars on my front. Like, I see two in the driveway and two out front. And as soon as they see me, guns drawn at me. And I was like, they're like on your knees, on the ground right now. And I'm like, what's wrong? What's going on? Like, what happened? Where is she? We got a call. There's someone being held up in your bathroom right now. Where is she? Tell us where she is. Is she okay? It's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Sir, stop lying to us. Show us where she is. So then I have an officer on my back, hands down, hands behind my head, on my knees, on the ground. officers on my back. I said, just go in the house. You can search everything. There's no one else in that home. So four officers go in. Two are outside with me. They come back probably 5-10 minutes later. And all of a sudden, you hear one of them on the radio say, oh, crap, we've got the wrong house. And within 15 seconds, guns holstered, they walk away, didn't say a word to me, and just left. And I was like, wait. If I had any other response, if I had gotten angry, if I was frustrated, what would have happened that day? No clue. No clue. But we have interactions. We all have stories of different interactions from time to time. And it's tough to kind of go through those situations and share them. So I appreciate you sharing that, because, you know, I think growing up, and I don't know if this is the same for you, but, you know, my mother was always, hey, always be very cautious, never, you know, never say anything loud, always be very respectful, do whatever they say. And as you get older, and I've had, you know, you have other friends of other races and cultures, they're like, wait, what do you mean, do whatever they tell you to do? You have rights. I'm like, wait, I mean, I have rights, but how much I want to really push those, I don't know, from time to time. It's your civil liberties, you got to stand up for them. Yeah, I do, but I don't know if I necessarily want to go to jail or get shot or be beat. So, you know, that's always been sort of a narrative for my parents young, and I'm not African-American, I'm not Dominican-American, I'm Indian-American, but I'm brown. And if you look at me, you never know. You couldn't tell where I'm from. Half the people I talk to think I'm Dominican, the other half think I'm Colombian, so I mean, it doesn't matter. But the point is, I think it's something that, you know, you kind of get used to growing up. And it's this time around, the time that this all hit, the time that it's broke, you know, with everyone being quarantined with COVID right now, it's something that comes to everyone's mind, because we're either working, or you're, you know, you're watching TV, or you're trying to stay busy, and so you can't really escape the coverage, you can't really escape the narrative, and it's been really, really interesting to see some of the names jump up and make statements and be very vocal and be very on top of being very poignant in what their beliefs are in this situation. You know, we talked about in an earlier episode, we talked about The Last Dance and how Michael Jordan refused to comment on anything political early in his career, and he wasn't really looked at as an activist and all of that. And, you know, The Last Dance illuminated the fact that, yeah, I didn't say anything publicly because I didn't know his stances, but I did look into it and I did end up donating to him. But to see him come out with the statement that he came out with, I think, what was it, Friday? It was crazy. Yeah, I didn't expect that from him. But to see someone like him step up, the one that kind of really shocked me was Joe Burrow, the new quarterback for the Bengals. Yeah. The Bengals came out, 23 years old, right? Went to LSU, so he's grown up in Louisiana. And his statement was, look, the black community needs our help. They've been unheard for too long. Open your ears, listen, and speak. It's not politics, it's human rights. And to hear a quarterback, the first pick of the draft, you know, a white ally who's going to be playing in Cincinnati, who lived most of his life in Louisiana, come forth and sort of say that, that was big. And you hear guys in the league talking about how important it is for allies to use their voice, because it's one thing to come from a black athlete, it's a completely different thing to come from a white athlete.
Yeah, Richard Sherman mentioned that, you know, a lot of white quarterbacks in the NFL have spoken out, have said something, you know, and Richard Sherman said, yeah, it's different. Richard Sherman's been speaking out about racial injustice, and he's been talking about social injustice for a long time. But he said it's different coming from someone who doesn't look like me. And it's different when you speak to someone that looks like you, right? And when an ally speaks, whether they're white or Hispanic or Asian, you know, a non-person of color speaks, they can speak more to their community and be listened to in a different way and provide a different perspective and essentially build a bridge to, let's take a look at it this way, right? or this bothers me. If you're a fan of mine, it should also bother you. Or at least think about it and think how you can help. How can you lend a hand? How can you lend your voice? Thank you for sharing your story, because I know that's very tough, and I remember that. But just like you, my mom, we were taught, there's 7 words you say to the police. Yes, sir. No, sir. Thank you, sir. Your question, you didn't push back. You didn't say anything other than those couple of words to the police. And I've never, ever imagined myself saying any other words to them other than those words.
And it's funny, because from a relationship standpoint, I had a great relationship with local police in Winter Park, Florida. And that was through classes, through school. I had an opportunity to work with them. And so I built those relationships. I have numerous friends that are officers. I have friends that are in SWAT. And understanding that piece and knowing them gives me a little bit comfort, right? Because I think you grow up with those ideas, I would argue that probably 98% of officers across this country are doing the right thing. But you think about how many officers are out there, 2%, that's a lot of people. Yeah. That's a lot of people out there. Or even 1% is a lot. And when you're in a position of power like that, when you have those percentages, they can do a lot of damage and they can do a lot of harm. And I hate going back to this, but it's the same thing about, all I can think of is The Last Dance, and hey, if you had 10 M&Ms and one of them were poison, right, would you eat them?
Yeah. Would you reach into the bowl? You didn't know what you were getting. Would you take one?
Yeah.
Like that. One could kill you. I had 10 in the bowl.
Yeah. And that's 10%, right? So, of course, the numbers, if we're going to go beyond the numbers, don't work out. But it's always, there's always that chance, right? There's always that chance that you're getting the wrong guy on the wrong day.
I think there's frustrations. And I think the young athletes, like you talked about, what our parents told us, the younger generation, the guys and professionals now were born in the 90s, which is crazy to think of, right? They were born early 90s. Some are born in 2000s. Actually, take that back, not early 90s. The guys that are professional now were born in the 2000s.
Yeah, 90s and 2000s.
They grew up in a different generation, a different time, and they've seen different than what we've seen. And I think it shows that the voice is being extended and that they feel confident enough to speak out and use their platform, where Michael Jordan didn't. And think of where Michael Jordan grew up, and he's a child of the 70s, right? Which was closer to segregation. He grew up in the South as well. And the guys that grew up today grew up far removed from that, when they're like, we're not gonna stand for this. We're gonna say something. We're gonna take a stand. And also, and Patrick Mahomes talked about a locker room. I'm fortunate and you're fortunate. We both played sports. And sports is a great equalizer, where it's like, it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is. It doesn't matter what your color is. If you can throw the ball 95 miles an hour, we love you. You're a ball player. You're a baseball player. If you can run a 4.4, okay, whether you're Dominican or Black or white or 300 pounds, you're on the team and you're there to help contribute on the team. And there's something to be said about being in a locker room environment. That's what Patrick Mahomes said. He's mixed. His father's Black. His mother's white. And from sports and being in the locker room with guys, you get to know guys from Oklahoma or Arkansas. You get to know white guys. You get to know Black guys. You get to know rich guys. You get to know guys from impoverished backgrounds. You get to know guys with both parents in the home. You get to know guys that were raised by their mom, guys that were raised only by a dad. So, not everyone has had that luxury of playing a team sport, playing something where you need the person next to you, regardless of what they look like. And you're going to work it out and you're going to work together because you have one common goal, and that's winning. And that's how we have to treat today, I think. We need to win against coronavirus. We need to win together as a team.
And not to go too deep, because I think this could go very deep, but I think at the core of what you said there and that idea is that sports are an equalizer because everyone has a purpose, and they bring something to the team that gives them value, right?
Yep.
And this is where, when you translate that to what we're seeing going on right now, there is a belief that this section of the population does not bring something of value, and thus their lives don't matter.
Man, that is deep. That's deep.
Right. And that's where it's a humanity issue. And I think that's the piece that you're starting to see athletes see that equation and play that out. So it's nice to see, it's good to see, it's great to see allies stepping up. I've had so many friends over the past week reach out to me just to remind me that they care, they're here, they want to be a part of the solution. And to me, the response I give is, look, my life is no different today than it was last week or 2 weeks ago or in February, right? These issues have always been real to us.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that you see them.
There's just camera.
And I'm grateful that you see them and acknowledge them and are reminded of them. But for me, this isn't something new. For you, it's not something new. It's just how we are.
Yeah. We've known about it for a long time.
So all of those listening out there, we do appreciate the love, the support. I know a lot of you have reached out. We see a lot of allies out there across the board that are trying to start meaningful conversations that will lead to lasting change. I truly believe we've reached a tipping point societally. And while athletes may be leading the way in some of the conversations because they have some of the largest platforms, I think we're starting to see that their message and the unity, the numbers are there to make the change happen.
Yeah, we have a long way to go in this country, but we should love one another and show compassion as human beings. Black Lives Matter. We stand with you and we love.
For our second story today, we're going to talk about the long journey towards starting up the 2020 MLB season. Fingers crossed, hopefully. The numbers for this story, 114, 50, 640,000, and 933 million. 114 is the number of games in the season proposed by the MLB Players Association that would start on June 30th and end October 31st. 50 is the number of games that was leaked earlier in the week and I think was in some ways confirmed later in the week on the non-official number of games the owners would come back with in response to the 114 game season. And this is essentially, well, we don't want to go to 114 because of how much we'll have to pay you. So we're going to come up with 50, which is significantly lower than the 82 original. And part of this is because of the $640,000, which is the estimated loss the owners are saying they would have per game in the 2020 season due to the lack of fans in the stadium. And that's, of course, taking into account you're not getting anything at the gate, but you're still paying your players. And $933 million is the dollar amount of payroll the owners proposed, down from the original $3.8 billion the players were scheduled to be paid in 2020. Now, at the beginning of this piece, the players were told that they would have a prorated salary. So 162 games, they were going to be $3.8 billion. In a prorated 82-game season, it would pay out to $1.9 billion. And the owners were originally willing to prorate, but afterwards they came back and looked at it and said, actually, we'd love to play 82 games, but we also only want to pay you $933 million for those 82 games. So that would be an additional 50% pay cut to that prorated rate that they had agreed on in principle earlier.
for those that don't know, in the ongoing efforts to start the season, Major League Baseball's owners have provided a sliding scale for pay to the Major League Players Association. The numbers play out as follows. Basically, players making roughly $35 million would make about $7.8 million. Players making $10 million would make around $2.9 million. Players making $1 million would make about $434,000. And players making the league minimum, which is actually $563,500, would make almost 100% of their salary. This proposal came after Major League Baseball's owners and the MLBPA, which is Major League Baseball's Player Association, agreed on the prorated salary for all players in the 2020 season a few weeks ago. Needless to say, this proposal from the owners was rejected by the Players Association.
So essentially, as we look at the situation now, this last proposal that the players gave out at the end of last week on Friday essentially said they would play 114 games and they would players would take no additional pay cuts. So they would take the 114 games at a prorated salary with no cuts across the board. So they would all make whatever they would proratedly make at 114 games. Not this sliding scale of we're going to, you know, that the owners have talked about. In addition, they were willing to defer $100 million if the postseason was canceled or shortened. They also want to expand the playoffs to 14 teams, so they would have a 14-team playoff this year, and that would also carry over to the following year. So essentially, a 14-team playoff would bring in more revenue to the teams. So this was looked at as a, hey, we'll play extra games, and we'll sort of enlarging the pot for more teams to kind of get in on that. So, and then finally, you know, the league looked at this, the owners looked at this and decided, hey, they, according to them, they would lose more money if they played more games, simply because the amount of cost it would be to take each game. So this is where we're kind of sitting at. And they do not want to really take anything on without the players taking a further salary cut.
Yeah, and I think an important caveat here, Ahmed, is, and for the listeners who may not know or may not follow the nuances between the different leagues or between baseball, the owners and the Players Association, one of the key differences I think that contributes to the story and part of the back and forth, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ahmed, is the owners do not disclose how much money they make. And so their argument is essentially, we lose money or we're going to be losing money. Therefore, you players should take a pay cut, but they don't open their books. So we don't know if that's necessarily true.
That is completely true. And this is one of the points of contention. So the owners came up with this $640,000 per game loss, but they're not showing why or how. That's sort of their internal calculations. They've been very, very hesitant to share anything. And if you look at what the players are saying on social media, it says, hey, open your books up and show us. Show us what you're making. And then we can talk about it from there. And, you know, all these TV deals and all that still pay out a good amount of money if they play these games. So I think, you know, both sides kind of hiding away from and shying away from that transparency piece. I know the big part on the player side has always been not wanting to have any sort of salary cap tied to revenue. So like where the NBA, the NHL, football, they all have salary caps built in. So based on the revenue coming in, your salary cap is adjusted to what you can make. So that's kind of set, which is why you look at a lot of these other leagues, it's much easier for them to start back up their seasons because they don't have to think about the revenue piece of it. It's kind of built into their CBA. And players aren't even willing to do a, hey, just for 2020, can we do that? Because based on timing, this current collective bargaining agreement for the players goes up in 2021. So anything they agree to this year, they fear will be used against them at the bargaining table in 2021. So that's a pretty big piece of it.
Yeah.
Now,
I was going to say, I think too, for our casual listeners, just to break it down, for me, it's almost like the owners are trying to pin the players against the people, the average person, right? Because we're talking about large numbers. We're talking about millions of dollars. And unemployment in this country hit 30 million people without a job, without any income. And we're talking about guys making $10 million having to make, you know, $3 million or still making millions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of dollars. But we're talking about owners that make billions with a B, which is exponentially more than the millions the players make and the limited amount of time players have to make that money in their careers, short careers, because of minor league system and things like that. So I just want to put that out there for our casual listeners. Yeah, it's guys that make millions of dollars to play a game, but at the same time, on the other side of that is the owners who make billions. They're not releasing numbers. They're not releasing data as to how much they make, how much they're worth, what their books look like, and the players are have an uphill battle, basically. And the owners put together a deal to show, look, the players don't want to play. They don't love you guys. They don't love you fans. They don't want to make less millions to show you some entertainment during this tough time.
You know, at the end of the day, I think all this comes down to, I think the owners, of course, are playing the optics game, and the players are looking at it from, hey, if I'm going to go out there and put my body in danger, you know, injuries, all that stuff, you know, depending on where I'm at in my contract, if I'm getting paid, you know, 20% of what I should get paid to do the same thing, you know, that could completely impact and change how I do next year, following years, the next contract I sign, you know. Because at the end of the day, all these stats that you combine, everything that you do in a season impacts what you end up making, right? So they want to make sure that they're, you know, maximizing what they're owed. So I get both ends of it. And to your point, like these are, we're talking about millions, right, in earnings, but these are billions that they're making off of it. So
yeah,
the numbers are bigger, but they can be scaled back to the same thing.
Right? If we're moving the numbers, you're being asked to take a 80% pay cut to do the same job. Basically, like your boss calls you up and says, yeah, we need you to come into work. Can you take an 80% pay cut? And, you know, we'll deal with that later. Are you taking a pay cut, boss? Yeah, let's not talk about that part. Why don't you take an 80% pay cut? I'm going to keep pocketing what I pocket on this side.
Exactly. So I think there's definitely a long ways away from reaching any sort of deal, but they need to do it quick. I would say by the time this podcast is published, I would hope they have a deal together because the amount of time they have to start a season is limited. Baseball, unlike, you know, basketball and hockey, outdoors. So winter does impact our ability to play. And a lot of these teams, so they're going to want to have something in place to get that season in so that your World Series is not being snowed out.
For our final story today, we cover ESPN's 30 for 30 Lance. Numbers for this story, 7-5. Seven, Lance Armstrong won the Tour de France 7 times in a row. Next closest person won it 5. 5, he was ordered to pay $5 million out of a $100 million, possible $100 million lawsuit from the U.S. government.
And specifically the U.S. Postal Service, right?
Yeah, U.S. Postal Service.
So for those of you that don't know, here are some definitions. So the Tour de France is an annual men's multiple-stage bike race. It consists of 21 day-long stages over the course of 23 days. It's been described as the world's most prestigious and most difficult bicycle races, and I think in many ways one of the most difficult physical challenges from an endurance standpoint in general. Lance Armstrong won the Tour de France, as Telly stated, 7 times in a row, after successfully beating testicular cancer. And Lance was the ESPN 30 for 30, sharing his story and sort of the rise and fall of the great Lance Armstrong. So Telly, you watched it, we both watched it. This wasn't The Last Dance, but this was still a very interesting, very polarizing character, and probably a story that we all kind of knew about, because of course, you know, this was a time, at least in our age, where this was something we were aware of, we knew what was going on, we had a sense of the scandal tied to it. So what were your reactions from watching this, and what do you think?
Can we call it The Last Lance? Instead of The Last Dance, The Last Lance.
You're smooth.
My reactions, first of all, I mean, the fact that it's called the world's most difficult bike race, those bicycle seats are extremely uncomfortable. And those bicycles are extremely small. So I can't imagine riding on them for 21 days on it through mountains, when it's cold out, when it's hot out, through a whole country, okay, 6 to 8 hours a day. So my initial reactions, my reactions in general, I'll just throw them all out and we can talk about them. He cray. It starts right off the bat with two fingers. I don't know that much about cycling. I think we all knew about Livestrong. I had a Livestrong bracelet, and I took pride in wearing that bracelet and supporting cancer, but it goes on his impact on cancer, and I didn't realize how large of an impact he had on cancer in general. And then it talks about, you know, steroids and his steroid use or his performance enhancing use. And they ask a question regarding his son, and his answer was really interesting. Those are my top line, top level reactions.
Yeah, so unlike The Last Dance, I think this is probably one that most of our listeners probably haven't watched. But if you get a chance, definitely watch it. Because I think it's quite interesting just to see his perspective and sort of him as a person. But yeah, definitely crazy. To kind of push yourself to that level.
From a young age.
Yeah, from a very young age. I mean, he was running triathlons at 17. Professional triathlons.
I didn't realize that his mom was forging his birth certificate so he could participate in triathlons when he was 15 years old, and he was beating grown professionals that were getting paid to do this, and he was beating them with no training, just showing up and doing it.
Yeah, just an incredible athlete across the board. And I think, you know, we're going to hit up some stats about sort of his reign and what happened around him in terms of the world of cycling. But yeah, I think it was a great documentary. I think there's, from a personality standpoint, he's got that same killer mentality. He has that same sort of hatred for his opponents that you kind of saw in Jordan through The Last Dance. I think there were some small similarities there in terms of just the type of athlete he was and the mental state he was in when he would race. So that was pretty cool to see from that standpoint. But just a very interesting take and just an interesting insight into someone that we kind of heard a lot of the negatives about. But there's a deeply flawed individual there that just has... It was just fascinating. Now, his son, that was interesting. I feel really bad for his son, simply because I feel like his own one goal in life is to prove to everyone that he's not his father, which is kind of a weird place to be at that young. I think his biggest reason to not take any performance-enhancing drugs is to prove to people that he didn't take them. Like, his statement was, well, if I took them and I got caught, it would just be like, well, like father, like son, and I don't want that piece of it. So, yeah. You know, it's tough, but you know, we can talk about some of the numbers, because I think as we both watched this and got a sense of Lance, but then we kind of dug into the Tour de France and what that entails, and I think from a number standpoint, it's a pretty fascinating sport. So I don't know if you want to kind of jump into some of those ideas. I don't know. What do you feel?
Yeah, we could do that. I will say similar. You mentioned Michael Jordan. So how Lance and Michael Jordan are similar, he spoke about making up mini beefs in his head, right? So you're riding on a bike for hours and he's making up stories about the dude in front of him in the bike talking about his mom and like catching up to guys. And there was a part, Amit, where he rode up to a dude he had beef with and put his hand on his back And that guy knew what was going on. And then he zips his finger across his mouth to the camera like, everybody on earth is watching this. And he's basically mafia style telling this dude, keep your mouth shut. That was crazy. That was crazy to me. Absolutely insane.
And to that point, I think that that's a nice little dovetail into, so, you know, we know he won seven in a row. We know he admitted to cheating. And I think some people have a brief idea that cycling has some cheating in it. But when we really look at it, right, from 1998 to 2013, that's 16 years, 12 of the winners in those 16 years were confirmed dopers. Right. And of course, Lance is in that range, right? Lance is in those. So you take away seven of those, right? Because that's him. But 12 of 16, right? In addition to that, 81 different riders who finished in the top 10 during that same period of time, 65% of them had been caught doping at some point, caught, admitted to, or had strong associations to it, and was pretty much, you know, like, hey, we know it, we just can't pin it on them. Crazily, and for specifically for Lance, in the 7 years that he won every Tour de France, 87% of the top 10 finishers, that's 61 of 70, were confirmed dopers or suspected of doping. And 48 of those were confirmed, and 39 of them had been suspended at some point before that. So this is something that's not unique to Lance. It's not unique to the postal workers team. This is a sport that essentially, to be able to complete it, you've got to take something. You got to be on something to be able to finish it, let alone finish it at the speeds that these guys do it at.
Man, sit on that seat for 8 hours every day for 21 hours. You got to do something.
I mean, so
yeah,
100%. And think about it this way, right? So to your point, right, they got to be on something. Until 1960, riders used to drink alcohol. They would drink to numb the pain. And then in the 60s, right, they were like, wait, alcohol might be a performance enhancer. Yeah. Right, because it was looked upon as a stimulant, and so they banned that. They banned alcohol in the 60s, and they just found other stuff to do.
Yeah, and it's no laughing matter, really. I mean, I was joking, but the documentary did a good job of explaining in this sport. Basically, they showed a scene, and Lance wasn't doing it early on when he first started and he got pro, right? And there was a scene, I don't know the names of folks, but somebody basically said, you either get on the bus, like you do this, or the people that don't have a job, right? This is your livelihood. This is how you earn money. Like, this is what you do. So you're either going to be on the team and do this, or you're not going to be on any team because you're not going to be fast enough or be able to compete with all the rest of us who are doing it. And I thought they illustrated that point. And so I feel like the other point was Lance really doesn't show much remorse throughout the documentary. And I feel like he justifies that by everybody was doing it. And so I fairly beat everyone that was on my level, right? Like, he, in his mind, he didn't beat anybody not doing it. He was the best of all of us are doing it, right? So to him, it's like, all right, we were all on equal ground. We were all doing the same thing, and I beat all of y'all. Not, oh, I took it, nobody else takes it. It's not fair.
Exactly. And that's, I think that's the best way to put it. He's not wrong. He's definitely not wrong about it. When you look at the sheer percentage and the numbers, and the fact that it was pretty much every single team had, and you know about it, right? You don't hide, you know, blood doping and doing all that stuff is not something you can hide, and it's not something that's, everyone's aware of it. So
yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the impact he had on cancer too, because I think that was extremely important and might get lost in some of this, you know, how the stigma of cancer before Lance Armstrong got it was very negative. It was essentially a death sentence. There wasn't a lot of spotlight shown on it. And also, especially testicular cancer and men coming forward and getting tested for cancer, all of that had improved with Lance Armstrong, and him winning 7 Tour de France titles after having cancer just gave people with cancer, fighting cancer, diagnosed with cancer, hope. I'm not dead. I'm not done. This isn't over for me. Like, I can fight and I can win the Tour de France. I can be great after this diagnosis. I can be great after I fight this. And I think before that, a lot of people thought they would be missing a piece of themselves, even if they had survived cancer. He showed that you can survive it and be even better than you were before.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of awareness, I think he, between him and his wife, raised a lot of awareness for things that even doctors necessarily weren't sharing with all their patients. So I think one of the parts that really stood out to me was this woman that was in her 20s when she had cancer, was worried about having children, and her doctor didn't tell her anything. And she saw, I think it was a People magazine article that Lance did with his wife at the time, talking about how they had to freeze his eggs because chemo could have negative impact on fertility and being able to conceive. And that wasn't something her doctor had even spoken about at any point.
Yeah.
So that was one of those where, you know, he definitely brought some awareness. I think anyone, they interviewed quite a few people that had gone through cancer treatment both before and after sort of his explosion onto the scene and after his sort of popularity. And overall, cancer treatment, the perception of cancer, the stigmas around it, and sort of even the motivation behind beating it is completely different pre-Lance to post-Lance. And you can't take that away. I think he made some very, very bad mistakes. He's a very flawed individual, but he also helped a lot of people do that.
And this was the crux, and this is what made the documentary so interesting, Ama, is basically, can you separate, you know, the sins of the man from the good that he did, right? Like, can you remove, like, him winning 7 times, but he admitted to doping, with the positive impact that his foundation had, the awareness to cancer? That lady that you spoke of, you know, that was very touching because she started a foundation to raise money and awareness for people who needed to freeze their eggs or freeze their sperm before they enter treatment. It's very expensive. She said as a result of Lance Armstrong and her reading that People magazine in the lobby, thousands of children, if not, you know, hundreds of thousands of children have been born from that. And how you separate that from a guy, the documentary starts with guys yelling F you at him, cheater. He gets that, right? So he saved thousands of lives, responsible for tons of, you know, thousands of babies, better cancer treatment, better cancer facilities, removing a stigma off of one of the most deadly diseases that plague this earth. And you cheated riding a bicycle. And that's the whole thing. And at the end, even his teammate, one teammate said, dude, I've known him for years, and usually I know whether I like somebody or I don't. And I don't know if I love Lance Armstrong or hate Lance Armstrong. And he's known him for years.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I love that you brought that up. I think it's such a hard piece. And honestly, for me, the fact that he cheated isn't even the issue. It's more of how he went after people that accused him of cheating.
The lying.
Just ruthlessly going after them, knowing that what they were saying was true. And that's what got me. And he talks about the spiral of, at some point you have to keep doubling down. You gotta keep doubling down. And the louder you scream no, the more you're hopeful that people will believe you. And that was the tough part.
Let's wrap this thing up. For our first story, we talked about athletes speaking out about racial injustice in America and shared some of our personal experiences as well.
For our second story, we talked about MLB's proposal to bring baseball back in 2020 and the huge divide between the players and the owners.
For our final story, we gave our thoughts on ESPN's 30 for 30, Lance, a 7-time Tour de France winner and testicular cancer survivor, Lance Armstrong. Thank you for going beyond the numbers with us. We're a weekly podcast dedicated to going beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter.
We're available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Whatever you're listening on now, please be sure to click the follow or subscribe button to get our latest content.
And remember, you can find us on Instagram, Beyond the Numbers Podcast, and on Twitter at Beyond TN Podcast.
Until next time, peace.